I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit about the new axis of evil. We've got Russia, Syria, and Iran all ganging up there in the Middle East and in that part of the world. Jim, what is Putin's plan? What is the game that he's playing here?
Nobody's sure. I mean, that's the most direct and most, how should I put it, pithy answer. What appears to be going on, he's making a typical, what do I have to do to survive play. Now, this is the oldest ploy in the book for an autocrat. Now, he technically is the ruler of a democracy, but it's one of those directed democracies which have become all the rage since World War II. He basically more and more, he's basically turning Russia back into, you know, an autocracy, like was under the Tsars and the communists. And he finds that if you package it and sell it the right way, you can actually get away with it. So far, he is. The trouble is, it's the classic, I've got the tiger by the tail, how do I let go without getting, you know, torn to pieces by the angry tiger, meaning Russia. And this is the classic conundrum with dictators the world over. I mean, this is what's happening with the Assads in Syria. You know, how do we get out of this mess we created? Well, let's blame it all on ISIL. Islamic terrorists, and basically say, now this sounds very much like Hitler in 1943. We're not really Nazis. We're really crusaders against the Bolshevik menace, which Hitler thought, and many of his cronies thought, was the one thing that could get him allied, you know, realigned with the Western allies. Well, it didn't work. And it rarely works. I mean, in antiquity, you know, I'm sure the Russians can count, quote some czar or whatever, what have you, who might have pulled it off momentarily. So Putin is running in place to try and stay alive. And in a situation like that, you make a deal with the devil, or in this case, the Ayatollah and the Assads, and basically try and, keep the game going long enough to stay in power. Putin is playing, according to many Russians I have spoken with, a very dangerous game, because the majority of Russians may be more comfortable with a strong ruler. That's a Russian thing. But actually, it's very popular in many countries. That's how Hitler came to power. It's how Roosevelt, managed to run for re-election so many times. You know, he may not be ideal, but he seems to get things done, and he's the devil we know. And, of course, right after Roosevelt died, they passed, they amended the Constitution to prevent any more Roosevelts. It goes all the way back to the ancient Romans and the consular system. You know, 1 year, you're gone, all sorts of, we can have a dictator temporarily, et cetera, et cetera. It is not a new problem. But what is a recurring problem is the autocrat, the dictator, who has to create an external, crisis in order to keep his domestic critics from throwing him out or overthrowing him, as the case may be. And this is what the clerical dictatorship in Iran is doing. This is what China is doing, which is still literally a communist police state. You know, the armed forces take their, swear allegiance to the Communist Party, not to Russia, I mean, not to China, not to the Chinese people, but to the Chinese Communist Party. And that's a point a lot of Westerners miss. You know, Russia no longer has that. They want to bring it back. They're basically reinstituting, a form of autocracy, which a lot of Russians would just assume, leaving the rearview mirror. But it's catching up. I mean, the problem in all these countries is they can't outrun their past. Their past keeps catching up with them. And Syria, Iran, and Russia, the leaders of all three of those countries, have the same problem, and they see the same solution, Islamic terrorism. Now, it gets, it's tragicomic in that the Iranians have a whole department in their government, the Quds Force, which specializes in Islamic terrorism, but done from a Shia Islam perspective. The source of ISIL, you know, the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and what have you, is Saudi Arabia, which feels most threatened by what it created. You have the same situation in Pakistan, where in the late 70s and in the 1980s, the generals who are temporarily running the government, as they have done for half the time since Pakistan was created in 1947, 1948, they basically decided Islamic terrorism is a weapon we can use to finally defeat India, because conventional weapons aren't doing it. And now that, you know, the sorcerer's apprentice, you know, it got out of control, and now they've been forced to admit that, yes, the Islamic terrorism, which is basically being, supported and egged on by the United States and India. I mean, a lot of people in Pakistan and the Arab world are in denial, as it were. They believe that ISIL was created by the United States. I mean, they really believe that. I've had people, some people, educated people in that part of the world, tell me with a straight face, I don't know how you people did it, but how did you create ISIL? And, you know, at that point I say, hey, you want another drink? The problem is one that has no easy solution. Historically, these things just tend to collapse from their own weight. These people are building houses of cards, as it were, each card being another lie. And eventually the weight of the lies becomes so heavy that it goes boom. Now, it's ironic because the Russians went through this in 1991 when the Soviet Union disappeared. And here we are, what, 25 years later, and they're basically going through it all over again. The whole business in the Middle East with the Islamic, with the dictatorships and monarchies and what have you, is the fact that the Arabs will never admit that the problem is them. You know, the old saying from the 50s, we have met the enemy and they are us. That is the problem that the Saudis have been funding what they call an Arab reform movement, whose main purpose is to get more people to accept just that, that the problem is internal, not external. It's been slow going. Because for centuries, the Arabs have been saying, because the Arabs basically went into a tailspin, you know, almost 1,000 years ago. They've been ruled by other people until, you know, after World War I, for centuries. And now they are saying that all that wasn't our fault. It was someone else. It was external forces, and we've been held down. And it had nothing to do with us. You know, it's like, well, why wasn't somebody ruling the Turks? Why wasn't somebody ruling the Iranians? Why wasn't somebody, you know, building an empire in the West? You know, why the Arabs? And some people in the Saudi royal family understand this. They say, you know, looking at this, you know, going to Oxford wasn't such a bad idea. It got me to thinking, and that turned out to be dangerous in the royal family, because there are a lot of people who say, no, wait a minute, what's these crazy ideas, you know, Akbar is having? We all know it's the fault of the West, and it continues to be. But in the meantime, we have these religious fanatics who keep popping up, and we have to do something about them. So, I mean, there you are. Delusions are another, you know, how should I put it, problem that you always run into when you're running an ancient empire. And that's basically what the Arabs are doing and what Saudi Arabia is doing. Their entire reason for remaining in power is the prolongation, you know, keeping going, you know, the ancient Arab government, monarchy, as it were, you know, in Arabia, to basically safeguard the holy places. And by the way, apparently the latest numbers are nearly 1,700 people died in the latest Hajj accident, which is really just a symptom, as it were, of the bigger problem. There is, you know, the cure comes from within, not from without. And that's the tragedy. There's not a whole lot we can do. I mean, we're basically trying to protect ourselves. But with all the trillions of, over $1 trillion we gave to the Arab countries who have oil, especially in the Persian Gulf, we have basically funded all this international terrorism. You know, for centuries, it was all internal. you know, they were killing each other. And, you know how that was a curiosity, you know, page 10 news in a 10-page newspaper. But now, you know, it threatens to come home. Although, you know, because they don't subscribe to education as much as their major enemy in the West does, they really haven't been able to muster much. I mean, you know, the 9/11 attacks, you know, bringing down the World Trade Center, you know, that was their peak. And a lot of them realize, you know, we're never going to get that close again, because, you know, now they're onto us. So most of the killing is internal. And indeed, you know, as people keep pointing out, even some Arabs keep pointing out, you know, we kill each other more than the West ever did. And now we've got better weapons and we can do it, you know, faster. So what are we going to do about that? Well, we're going to blame the West. So there you are.
Austin?
Well, I tell you, central focus here, you said, was this what you call the new axis of evil, which you said was Russia, Iran, and Syria. I actually think there are more hubs on this axis down, and I realize that we talked about North Korea several times. There are other bad actors out there. I'm not going to put China quite in the same category as Russia, but we're going to have to come back on Strategy Talk to the South China Sea, because I think it's within the next couple of weeks the Navy, U.S. Navy, is going to start patrols in the South China Sea to test China's response to its defending its now militarized sea features, where they've created those islands. So, but to get back to the way we're frame the topic today. Jim's analysis of Russia is historically correct, and as he says, it's not quite sure what Putin is up to in some of his gambits or his endeavors, and Syria is certainly one of his endeavors, but we're pretty sure we know what he's up to internally, and Jim gave us both a commissar and czar, an analysis that applies to commissar and czar. It's a Russian strongman leading his own private kleptocracy. Let's put it that way. But Putin, let's take a look at it. Syria, Dan, is there's no doubt the Assad regime has participated in past axes of evil, but right now it's in dire straits. It's getting what it deserves in many respects, but at the same time, the chaos inside Syria has been exploited by, well, Iran. Iran is one of Syria's chief, it has been until Russia intervened, the Assad regime's major supporter. The power vacuum created in Syria brought about the Islamic State in the Levant, as we call it on Strategy Page, ISIL, the Islamic State. And, of course, at the same time, U.S. withdrawal from Iraq permitted the growth of ISIL. So what I'm saying is that Syria is more a convenient battleground for both tribes, terrorist organizations that have links to tribes, terrorist organizations that have links to states, and now Russia as well. Why did Putin intervene? Well, for one thing is, and I think I said this on a past on another radio program, I put that I was interviewed on, is that for one thing is that this gives him an opportunity to demonstrate that being a friend of Russia or a friend of Putin pays off. In other words, we'll act on your behalf as America withdraws, but and won't stand by you, but we will. Also, it has the appearance, and there's some things that both Jim and I have said about how actually brittle or fragile Russia is right now militarily, at least compared to United States, NATO, and China, but it gives him a chance to act as if he were that Russia were still a global power, firing cruise missiles, sending naval units, putting Marines into Syria, and propaganda and information is extremely important to Putin. No question about that. As for Iran, Jim's analysis of what Iran's up to is absolutely dead on. The Iranians are they're a theocratic dictatorship, which means at the core they're just a dictatorship in robes, and they want to stay in power. And part of the way staying in power is brutality, militancy, and that stymies internal opposition. They rally a nationalist spirit by externalizing some of their, waging war, and plus they're backing up in Syria the Assad's or Alawites. They're nominally a Shia offshoot, and that's an extension of as their Shiite brand of Islamic revolution. So, welcome to the cauldron in Syria. But it has what has happened to since Russia's intervention. I'm point this out to some degree. Iran is fighting a proxy war with Turkey and NATO in Syria, and now Russia's joined that, which makes it you've got and the Russian violations of Turkish airspace are there. Turkey has not talked again of invoking NATO Article 5 because there hadn't been an attack, but those are quite serious. Turkey's right to respond call him serious, and we're close to the kind of incident where Turkish Air Force shoots down Russian aircraft. And does so legitimately over Turkish airspace. Now we've got a different kind of crisis, and one, though, that I'm not sure how Putin would react because he doesn't have the capability to take it on NATO. So I'll turn it over to you and Jim there.
Jim, on the proxy war thing, the U.S. claims they're not in a proxy war. So if one side says it's not a proxy war, is it not a proxy war?
I think they're being semantic there, the Bill Clinton School of press releases. We are not willing to get involved enough in Iraq or Syria to risk American lives because that is political suicide domestically. The problem is we need someone or something to deal with this because we know from experience that if the evil offshoot of Al Qaeda, that sounds like an oxymoron, if they establish a unmolested base in their caliphate, which is now mainly portions of western Iraq and eastern Syria, they can do all sorts of mischief, and mainly threaten the West literally. I mean, as they have done in the past. And the security organizations in the West are coming up daily with new evidence that this is exactly what's happening. For example, I did an update on Libya today, and one of the pieces I came across was how Tunisia is catching a lot of ISIL attempts to get into Tunisia. And there are similar attempts getting into Algeria. In other words, basically setting up cells in these countries to launch more attacks. And these attempts, and the latest one in Tunisia, involved three cars, crossing the border, illegally and getting caught. And the people involved jump into one car and speed off. But the other two cars turn out to be full of weapons, and both of those cars are rigged to be suicide car bombs. So, and of course, there was a large quantity of ISIL, propaganda. So what does that tell you? They'd love to have the same kind of access to Western Europe, which they may get one of these days, and to do the same kind of, lethal mischief. So this is basically, where you have to get involved one way or the other, And we're finding that there is no way to deal with it hands off. It's still there. Now, the Russians may do us a favor because they're willing to go in and get their hands dirty. They don't have any restrictive rules of engagement, what have you. And they have a reputation, which helps them, like sort of like the Gurkhas, socialist Gurkhas. And, you know, that they will basically do anything, you know, rules don't bother them. They will just, you know, do whatever they have to do. And this does bother ISIL because Russia's basically playing by ISIL rules, which is no fair as far as ISIL is concerned. But, you know, another asset we have is the Arab world, because they are most directly threatened. I mean, the road to Western Europe and North America goes through Arabia. That's one reason why the Arabs, especially Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, have been more willing to give supply, to give weapons and what have you, to organizations, not necessarily ISIL, which is the biggest threat. I mean, that's even beyond the pale. But there are many of what I call, moderate maniacs. You know, Al-Qaeda, suddenly Al-Qaeda is the good guy, because they're the lesser of two evils. But ultimately, you're going to have to face, this problem because it's not going away. And as we have explained many times, the strategy page, it's an old product. I mean, it goes back over 1,000 years. It's a holier than now feud fought, with lethal weapons in the Muslim world, especially in Arabia. There are many other Muslim countries which don't really want to be bothered with this. But that's the tragicomic irony of all this is that, the Arabs, talking about only the Arabs in Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, have created this mess. And, they are best, situated to deal with it, but they can't quite do it because a lot of them still agree with it. I mean, the classic example is in 2003 when we went into Iraq, this outraged Al-Qaeda, which had an unofficial truce, as it were, with Saudi Arabia, where they could be in Saudi Arabia as long as they didn't blow anything up, kill anybody. The Al-Qaeda broke that truce by launching, trying to attack Saudi targets. I mean, they also went after, guarded, compounds which held the Western, the people who keep the oil flowing. But they basically killed a lot of Saudis, and that was beyond the pale. And bingo, within a year or two, there is no more active Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. So it shows you it can be done. But the Saudis are basically conflicted because a lot of Saudis still finance outfits like ISIL. They still cheer whenever a bomb, an Islamic bomb goes off in the West and kills, non-Muslims. They'll cheer if bombs go off in some other Muslim country that is populated largely by Shia, because the government in Saudi, the predominant groups in Saudi Arabia are Sunni, and they believe Shia are heretics and should be killed. So you have a disease which is local, mainly its vector. It comes from Saudi Arabia, and the Arabians are victims. They're not immune to it. Yet they will not do what has to be done or what should be done to suppress it. And there has been efforts. I mean, there have been official efforts. Like I said, the Arab, reform movement is trying to get people to, basically take a less fanciful look at what exactly is going on here. And that's not been all that successful. I mean, there have been a lot of conferences held, paid for by the Saudis, bringing in Arab Muslim experts and what have you. And they make all these speeches, but they all dance around, exactly where it's coming from and exactly who is responsible. But there's no denying the body count and the fact that most of the bodies are Muslims.
Austin?
I have very little to add to that. Jim's talking about a cultural decline. As he said, it has started a millennia ago. I'll just add that it wasn't strictly the Arabs. Some of it was tied to a turning away from education. Jim mentioned the revival of respect for education, at least among some Arab elites, both Arab economic and educational elites. I don't mean to be a tautology there, but that of respect for what we call classical liberal education. But it happened in Ottoman Turkey as well. You got what went wrong, the classic study of Ottoman decline, but the same elements are at play in Arab Muslim world as well. And it's tough to it's easier to blame someone else than accept responsibility for your own situation. And that's I'm summarizing basically two sentences that Jim said. It's something that we've been writing about forever. I mean, it comes up in the first edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, back in 1985, Dan, this issue. So it's easier to export the internal revolution and redirect it as a religious war against Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, and the like, instead of dealing with the decline internally and trying to turn it around. One of the great wastes, sad stories, is all the wealth that has gone into the Arabian Peninsula, thanks to the gift of oil. So much has been squandered. Certainly hadn't been used in the for the long-term benefit of the people in the region, and I'm not saying that as the outsider, the Westerner, sitting in the United States shaking his finger at Arabs. Not doing that at all. I'm saying something I've heard many of the Arabs I know, predominantly Arab Muslims, that I have said that that's. That's one of the sad stories of our time. They're aware of it. It's just they don't have the they don't have the reins of power, or as a I will say this. This was a Syrian who told me this. Very educated Syrian, and this is in the early 80s. Dan, he says, it's not that we just don't have the access to power. Is if we say something, we risk. Losing our lives. And when he said that, he cocked his right thumb and used his index finger as if it were a barrel and put it against the right side of his head, meaning to say that that was the way that protest was silenced in Syria. But that applied throughout the Arab world. And this fellow was highly educated. He had been educated predominantly, for the most part, in Syria, but was extremely aware of the truncated educational background of most of the Arab Muslim world. He could also see, and this is he wasn't the only one bringing this up, also see that some Arab Christians had an educational advantage, and he knew the answer to that was because they'd been encouraged to it, and if they had family connections or the like, they'd succeeded in studying in Western Europe or getting their way to the American University in Beirut or taking advantage of other educational opportunities like that. Scattered throughout the Middle East, most of them run by Western universities and sometimes Christian religious organizations. Just to toss out another example of that, I've got another Arab Muslim friend who went to for 3 years to a Jesuit run high school, and I'll say where that it's no longer exists, but it was in Baghdad, and he told me that that changed his life. Not only did he really learn how to speak English there, he was exposed to all of this other learning, not just out of the West, but out of the rest of the world. And it wasn't that he had been totally isolated from it, because Iraq had a more secular educational orientation, but it sure wasn't like going to that classic Jesuit classic education that Jesuit school offered. And I'm giving here some anecdotes, and of course I'm not attaching names to them because I've really run through, even though I've done it in three stories, about six different people I know. Four of them still live in their home countries. And it's a volatile situation. But there are anecdotes, Dan, that back up Jim's point about the educational deficit. And again, it also backs it up that there are plenty of very well-intentioned Arab Muslims that know that this is the problem. And if they have the opportunity, they change it.
Well, it looks like one of the problems that's going to with this axis is that Russia is going to be able to keep the Syrian government stood up, and Iran is going to be able to continue with their mischief.
I don't see how Iran is not going to continue with its mischief, and then we need to come back and talk about the so-called Iran nuclear deal. I noticed that we've not really discussed that, but
right. Well, it's time for us to wrap up. The amount of detail that there is in just this whole mess that continues to grow, the cauldron continues to boil. The question is, when will it boil over and it become something that sucks in all the Western powers and the other Arab powers?
Dan, it's boiled over. It's boiled over, and the Western powers have been sucked in. I mean, Libya, the whole thing, it's been boiling. It's just a question of when do you want to say that it got out of the pot?
Another 9/11 would do it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's something nobody on our side wants. But, you know, unfortunately, if the Muslim fanatics manage to get what they want, they'll get what they don't want.
Especially if they do it with a nuke, Dan. And, you know, oh, Austin, don't say that. That's paranoid talk. No, it's not. It is not. It's concerned talk because it could. That's the devastator. That's the real devastator.
Right. All right. Well, we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, guys.
Till then. Bye-bye.